All right, the title may be a little bit misleading. That is, yes, the first half is about Mona Lisa. The second half may not be what you want to hear, but we'll see. All right, so I need to make a bit of an advertising speech for microsociology. So the pitch is this. It's the small details of things are the clues to social relationships. That is, what hold things together, what creates social solidarity or cohesion in varying degrees, and also what causes conflict and change. The predecessors, above all, on the empirical side are Goffman and the ethnomethodologists, but I'm not claiming to be orthodox followers of any of them. Theoretically, the connection, as some of you know, is really trying to revive Durkheim as a microsociologist and synthesize this with a symbolic interactionist approach. But primarily, this is really methods-driven. Ethnomethodology came up as a movement in the 60s above all, not so much because I think of Harold Garfinkel's somewhat arcane theorizing, but above all because of the availability of portable tape recorders, and hence an entire new way of getting accessible data on the micro details, first on the auditory level, and then since the 90s, basically we've been in the era of visual data, videos, now omnipresent CCTV, mobile phone, and cameras, and so forth. At the center of microsociology today, where the theoretical accumulation is happening, is the sociology of emotions. And now I know this sounds like a big overlap with psychology, and then how could a Durkheimian do this? Well, emotions for the most part are generated in social interactions. Almost all the emotions we're interested in are the ones which happen that people get them because of other people, or as messages that they send to other people. An additional twist on this is what we can call, in a Goffmanian vein, the front stage presentation of the emotional self. But Arlie Hochschild, another one of Irving Goffman's students, Arlie and I were actually in the same cohort at Berkeley. There's what she calls emotion work. In other words, the presentation of self is above all a presentation of a self as having certain kinds of emotions. And I'm making an argument that it's a major device for all sorts of things, that indeed I'm coming more and more to the conclusion that this, if you look at how authority is enacted in real situations, whether it's accepted or not, the cues to it are quite heavily in the emotional relationship between people. And this includes many other things, all ranging from high solidarity through conflict. All right, so doing emotion work. Modern politics, when you look at it, is heavily a matter of front staging certain kinds of emotional expressions. Now, the style of doing this has definitely changed over history. It's interesting to go back and look at photos of Winston Churchill. You know, that era people didn't do this. You know, there was a totally different way of presenting yourself in those days. I think this started in America. We can actually do historical microsociology because it's possible to access all kinds of archives of historical photos. So we can go back to at least around the 1920s, to chart when and where things happen. Okay, we can probably quite intuitively see that those are not real smiles. Here's another example. So I could call this the polite formal occasion smile. This is the mark of the upper class, or at least the contemporary upper class. Again, if you go further back into history, that, you know, that pattern changed. But this is definitely the way people attempt to show themselves. And indeed, it's, you know, if you did, were more dynamic about it, see, the upper class are the people who you can't really wipe the smile off their face, right? You know, they hold on to that smile. There was a woman prime minister of Turkey about 15 years ago named Tursa Selar. She was called the lady with the iron smile. Okay, I need this. Shoot, go back. I can't go back on this. Where's over here? Where do we need to go? Okay, yes, all right, good. I think one reason why we like children is they have not yet learned how to do emotion work. This is a genuine smile. The full photo shows that she's got a puppy on her lap who's tickling her. All right, now our folk culture says that smiles are done with the mouth. See, so, you know, we have these little icons, the smiley face, the frowning face, etc. You know, and so when we put on, we do emotion work and try to generate expression, we do the work with our mouth. I hope you've read this, I won't say what's on it, where we're going to. So here's the Mona Lisa. As of the 20th century, this has been declared the most famous painting in the world. It wasn't always the most famous painting, and it's famous above all because of the puzzle of the expression on her face, the Mona Lisa smile. Now, what I'm going to attempt to do, more or less as an exercise in demonstrating what you can do with some of the tools of microsociology, is to take apart her expression and see what it actually is, and to see what makes it so mysterious. In this area, I'm following the research tools provided by Paul Ekman, a psychologist from San Francisco. Who has done research worldwide on facial expression of the basic emotions. I emphasize the worldwide part of this because he has done this in many different cultures and has evidence that at least there are at least six basic emotions which are expressed and recognized the same way in all cultures. There are many more complicated emotions, and people can do various things on top of those emotions, but it's an argument that this is indeed fairly reliable for a certain kind of hardwired expressions. All right, so Ekman points out emotions are expressed on three different zones of the face. The mouth and lower face, as I was just saying, that's the part where we conventionally think that emotions are. The area around the eyes and the area of the eyebrows and forehead. Now, bear with me as I'll read this for the sake of the recording. So we'll start with the lower zone. In the mouth and the lower face, stronger smiles pull back the corners of the mouth further back. And by back, I mean back towards your ears. I mean back up, right? So it's a pulling them back that way. So the corners of the mouth may tilt up, but they don't have to. The idea of the little smiley face with the corners turned up is not really basic to the smile. Very strong smiles which pull the mouth open and expose the teeth often leave the line of the upper lip horizontal. What you get that looks bow-shaped actually is the lower mouth, and as you can see, particularly the middle and the right of these three intensities of smiles. So the one on the left, the mild smile, you can easily recognize that as a smile, but it's not a smiley mouth in the strong sense that we're concerned of. Okay. What's especially important is the wrinkle called a nasolabial fold, that runs from the corners of the nose diagonally down beyond the corners of the lips. In very strong smiles, these triangle-looking folds become deeper and are matched by a flipped-over triangle of skin folds from the chin to the outer corners of the lips, giving the lower face a diamond-shaped look. Okay, so now look at the one on the right. As the smile gets more intense, the nasolabial folds become deeper. And the mouth here is kind of falling open, so it's getting more bow-shaped. But it's more important to see this. See, that's the really strong smile. It actually has that diamond shape to it. Now, we could go back to the original ones, you know, Sarkozy and so forth, and see, you know, where they're lacking even on the mouth side of it. They're working really hard on a certain shape of the mouth, which actually isn't the right shape. I don't want to pick on Mr. Sarkozy. I mean, I've got ones for American politicians, too, and sad to say I've got ones for Brits and so forth. Okay. All right, so Mona Lisa's mouth. Well, all right, so where's the smile here? It's our conventional and inaccurate picture of the smile. That is, you turn up the corners of the mouth. But there are no nasolabial folds in it at all. Now you could ask what was Leonardo's intention and so forth. He did spend 3 years working on this painting, obviously not with, you know, Mrs. Gioconda sitting there all that time. So he's aiming at a certain kind of effect, and certainly this is what, 60 years into the Renaissance, where the painters vied with each other over realistic effects that they could make. So he's trying to make some sort of effect. I think he never regarded this painting as finished. Yeah, maybe with good reason. But at any rate, it has the very appearance of a smile, maybe the slightest kind of smile. I'm even slightly dubious about that, because turning up the corners of the lips and doing nothing else is so rare. Okay, let's go to the eyes and eyelids. Smiles make wrinkles below the eyes, more or less horizontal, slightly curved across the bottom of the eye socket. Deeper wrinkles the more the cheeks are raised. I'll just skip forward for a second. See, this is a really good one. Notice she has got that full diamond shape, mouth zone. You can strongly see the wrinkles underneath her eyes. Now, let me just shuttle back here. This has the effect of narrowing the slit of the eyes as the lower eyelid is raised. Narrowing eyes can also happen in other emotions, so you have to be careful to look at the details. But in other emotions, the lower eyelid may be puffed out but is not tense. So a smiling face is a happy face, and it is not at all a tense face. So there's a bit of a contradiction in working at putting on a smile, because make your face look tense and smiling at the same time. I'm not going to run through all the emotions, but key thing about the anger face is the face is totally tense, in every zone. I've used fear and anger in other presentations. I won't belabor that right now. The final point. In the happy face, these muscle movements called crow's feet wrinkles to spread out from the corners of the eyes. And we can see that really nicely in this picture. The sort of the smiling eyes have both that and this. So let's look at Mona Lisa's eyes. The lower eyelids are a little bit puffy, but there's no indication at all that it's because the cheek muscles have been raised. There are no eyelids are not particularly narrowed, and at any rate, Leonardo made no effort to create crow's feet around the corner. Now, there is an argument that he has this famous so-called smoky technique, the sfumato technique that he was admired for. So precisely, kind of smoking out the details of things is what he was aiming at. And that's one of the things that actually makes it difficult for us to read it as a, you know, straightforward painting. But clearly enough, they're not smiling eyes. So what kind of eyes are they? Okay, so I look through Ekman's handbook. Okay, where is it? I've got it. These are sad eyes. Now, Ekman made this into a composite photograph. See, he's the lower zone of the face is neutral. He has the same model, so he's kind of pasted a neutral lower face onto sad eyes. Okay, so what makes the eyes sad? All right, so let's read what he says. Sad eyes are passive. The lower eyelid is weak, and there is no horizontal wrinkle below it, since the cheek is not pushing up. Right back there. See, so you know, kind of, so it's all very smooth below the eyes. Right? The bottom part of the face is just okay. Whereas in a smile, the upper eyelid is open, so the eyes brightly look out. I mean, that's for that expression, you know, having bright eyes. It's not that the light shines out of them. It's just that, you know, you're seeing a lot of eyeball. In sad eyes, the upper eyelids droop a bit. All right, so see a bit of this here. Got one more line to read, and then we'll look more carefully at those photos. The brow, which tends to collapse and droop downwards, this makes the skin of the upper eye socket. Now, we're not talking about the upper eyelid. We're talking about the skin right here, you know, sort of inside your eye socket. Droop like a veil, slanting over the outer corner of the eyes. Okay, so let's take a look. On the left, this is a woman. I've blown it up. She's being kind of helped by, you know, people on both sides as she walks, you know, kind of blind with this blind look on her face into the funeral of her dead lover. That's not a very recent photo. The one on the right is pretty recent. This is a woman who had been publicly raped in some of the demonstrations in Egypt, and then this is taken just after her case was thrown out. See, and look, you can see particularly well on her the lower part of her brow there hanging like a veil over her eyes. So that's very definitely the, you know, the sad eyes. Okay, so look at Mona Lisa. It's not as sad as these women, but they are mildly sad eyes. We could go to the brow, which expresses other emotions. Her brow is just completely blank. I mean, she's a wrinkle-free woman. And that's another thing that makes her somewhat mysterious, because so both the eyes are showing some emotion, the mouth is showing a different emotion, and the combination strikes us as mysterious. Okay, now let me add one more thing in here. You already read the bottom line here. It took me a long time to realize this because you're so concerned about her mouth. Mona Lisa has no eyebrows, right? So what difference does it make? Well, for us, eyebrows are actually very expressive. You know, so here, I mean, these are kind of like over-the-top enthusiasm look, where I'm putting so much energy into it, it's virtually coming out the top of my head. You know, in the case of Jimmy there on the left, the one on the right has an extraordinarily big mouth, you know, to work really hard at getting your mouth that wide open. But even her forehead is unmarked, but the, you know, dark eyebrows there are very dramatic. Here's another one. Now, anger is shown on all the zones of the face, but one of the clearest markers of anger is in the eyebrows. The eyebrows are pulled together, and they create vertical lines, extending the line of your nose up onto your forehead. This is a man in a court shouting angrily at somebody who's murdered his daughter. Back to Ekman again. There are two versions of the angry face. They are they're similar in the brow and eyes. They just differ in the mouth. You could have the clenched mouth look, tight mouth look, or the open angry shouting mouth. But the bottom line here is that the angry face is a completely engaged. The muscles of your face are completely engaged, and anger is used as a primary emotion to try to dominate other people. I mean, it's quite literally a face contest. My face is going to be stronger than your face. But, okay. Now, started looking through, history of painting books, realized that, in fact, the latter part of the 15th century was a period when it was a fashion for ladies to shave their eyebrows. See, so here's a Fouquet Madonna from 1452. It's pretty inexpressive as it is. This is too early in the Renaissance to be really concerned about emotions. This one's getting closer to the time, and in Urbino, actually. So Piero della Francesca portrait from 1465. The woman here perhaps is made to look intentionally bland. These are days when aristocrats did not have to have big smiles. And Mona Lisa is painted, a little less than 40 years thereafter. So it was merely the fashion at the time. All right. At the time when Mona Lisa was painted, it was not regarded as a particularly notable painting. I mean, Leonardo was quite famous for many things. Above all, his masterpiece was considered to be The Last Supper. No one, as far as we know, commented on anything mysterious about the Mona Lisa. It took a long time before it did become well known. Now, here's one in the early 19th century, Angra painting of Madame Duvauquet, 1807. And in fact, it is almost identical with the Mona Lisa, except she has eyebrows. So it has the same, slight little corner mouth, upturned, quasi smile, rather sad looking eyes, almost the same pose. But no one's ever commented on this. It's being particularly mysterious, and I think it's because the eyebrows make it look more conventional. Now, I will readily admit I've cribbed most of this historical information from Donald Sassoon, a book called Mona Lisa, The History of the World's Most Famous Painting, and he points out that the Mona Lisa was regarded as one of Leonardo's minor works until around the 1850s to the 70s. When first in France and then in England, the movement of ultra-aesthete art critics, Théophile Gautier and right here, Walter Pater, started adulating Leonardo's Mona Lisa. And their interpretation was that she was the essence of mysteriousness. And not only that, this mysteriousness was, she was the mysterious feminine with a capital F, the Salome, the Earth Mother, the sexual temptress, the seductress. I thought, well, let's test that out. Is this what, really sexy women look like? All right, so I confess to downloading this from certain sites on the internet, of which there are more than a few. And you can check it out. There are thousands of photos that look like this, and I have not seen one that in that sexual context that looks like this. All right, so much for Walter Pater. I'm not sure he knew about women anyway. So, all right, getting on to part two. I've tried to make the argument then that the visual analysis of emotions can be a key research tool, and that we have by now some of the basic methods for being able to read what the emotions are. And I give you two references here to books by Paul Ekman, one of them with a little bit more provocative title called Telling Lies, another one from 84 called Unmasking the Face, and then there's a huge handbook that goes through this in very great detail as well. And indeed, I encourage you to look up, you know, the literature on, by Ekman and his rather big school of comparative psychologists. You know, it's, I think this is, you know, pretty well established material. All right, so part two. I had to choose from a number of different pieces of recent research, because just now with so much more visual data becoming available and coinciding with having a theoretical frame that we can use, we're really starting to take off now with research which uses these sorts of methods. So I'm going to talk mainly about the PhD dissertation by Anna Nassauer, which she just defended at the Humboldt University in Berlin, which I'm familiar with as one of the members of her committee. And to a certain degree, she's testing out elements of my theory about microviolence. Now, her specific research is about the question of when did demonstrations end in violence and when did they remain peaceful? Her data is really pretty impressive. She's collected hundreds of hours of visual footage, especially taken by the mobile phones of people in protests. A lot of this posted online, some on specialized sites, some of you have to track down elsewhere. And she, so it's a genuine multimedia triangle. It's a double triangulation of sources, police radio traffic, Google Maps to pin down where everything happened. So you can get an actual real time-space picture of what happens in a demonstration. Now, what's important about that? I could see this already from my collection of photos of demonstrations, you know, from a slightly earlier period. Almost all photos of demonstrations I've seen, you can see people in markedly different kinds of activities. So kind of on the whole, particularly if it turns violent, there's a relatively small group of somewhere, usually when counting the people, it's about 5% of the people in a photograph are the ones who are actually doing the violence. And then you have some people who are their supporters, and you have a lot of people who are sort of backed up at a distance. Okay, so it's very important as far as analyzing a demonstration of, you know, which people are you looking at. And I think this is the first time we've actually been able to look at, you know, more or less most of the people in a demonstration and see what they're doing simultaneously, and also look at it from the police side and see what, you know, most of the police are doing as well. And she does 30 demonstrations in Germany and the U.S., plus a couple of others from outside that zone that had particularly good data to them. The point one to start with is that although we have the image of demonstrations and riots as, you know, kind of easily, you know, morphing from one to the other, in fact, most demonstrations are peaceful, and Nassauer selected from her sample so that she could more or less evenly match ones that turned violent, ones that didn't. Here's another example of a lot of demonstrations look like this. Now, as a matter of fact, this is one of the notoriously famous demonstrations, the anti-WTO demonstration in Seattle in 1999. But most of the demonstrators looked like this, right? You know, this that kind of worthy, unified look that Chuck Tilley talks about, the, you know, waving American flags, support American families, et cetera. The things that we're going to look at, I've written across the top here, the key are the time sequences, the emotional fields that build up, and the turning points. And here are a couple of details that I'm lifting from Nassauer's text. So this is the way she's describing, you know, things in one of the series of photos. A line of police outnumbered by protesters, tensing their muscles, holding their truncheons tightly, and looking nervously over their shoulders from attacks that might come from behind. But also photos where both the police and the protesters look calm and relaxed, even bored. You know, so NASSAUER is analyzing, you know, not only the facial expressions, but also the body language. And often she has audio data as well, so we're able to pick up on that. Okay. Now, I have to confess something here, and that is I don't, in this PowerPoint, have any of Annie Nassauer's actual images. So the ones that I've picked to kind of fill in and give you a sense of this are from my collection rather than her collection, and hers is a whole hell of a lot more extensive, and you can kind of get, you know, moment by moment. But I think you can get the general idea. Okay, so this is a demonstration, pretty famous demonstration, actually, Berkeley, 1964. We captured a police car and managed to shut down the university. I'm actually in this photo, but I'm not one of the ones on top. But I kind of want to point out to you the cops, you know, right? I mean, this demonstration did not turn violent. And certainly at that moment, there's no threat of it. The cops are kind of, they're looking a little, you know, bored and maybe waiting, like, you know, when can I get off duty? But they're, you can already see it. And again, you can see it from the audience, you know, and people up on top are like, you know, I don't know, is there room to get another microphone? You know, so there, you can see the atmosphere of it already. In contrast, okay, so this is actually from May Day in London, 2001, and violence hasn't quite broken out, but I want to direct your attention particularly to the officer on the left. See, the one on the right is trying to get somebody to move back. He's got a bit of that angry look. The one on the right looks worried, right? And actually, the worried look is more of an indicative of something that's really going to break loose, because when violence breaks out, the anger turns into this look of fear. I'm going to simplify Nassauer's analysis down to two kinds of pathways to riots. The first she calls a loss of control pathway, resulting in what is often called a police riot. And the key ingredients are two: a combination of spatial incursions plus police organizational breakdown. Spatial incursions are when either the demonstrators or the crowd control forces do not stay in the zone assigned to them. They deviate from the parade route, break through barriers, plunge into the opposing crowd. Opposing sides don't need to make physical contact in order to fight. I mean, I say this because you might think, well, it seems obvious you can't fight unless you actually make contact. But this is actually a somewhat different point because, in fact, violence is often carried out at a distance by throwing things or by firing. And indeed, most military violence is carried out at a distance, you know, and usually at a couple hundred meters, although sometimes you can get closer than that. But so spatial incursions actually mean physically you get your body gets into the zone that the other people regard as this is our turf. Incursions into the other side's turf shift the emotional field, and that is what typically opens up a period of sustained violence. And so when I talk about violence here, and when Nassauer talks about violence, she really means, you know, in effect, when the riot gets going. So, you know, now the violence, it's not just, you know, one or two stones that are thrown or, you know, the cop, you know, swings at one person, but it's as if the whole thing gets unleashed. And we'll see this in a few minutes. The whole structure of what a demonstration looks like changes totally when the riot gets going. I mean, you can spot it immediately. You'll see it as soon as you see the photos. Turf incursions produce an emotional grievance. The other side is not respecting an agreement. They are acting unfairly or irrationally and cannot be trusted. Okay? Now, this is another pretty famous demonstration, and indeed it did turn quite violent. But this is you can actually see from the photo, this is a period before it turned violent. And it's not really getting to that point. This is the famous anti-WTO demonstration in Genoa in 2001. Now, this, the pattern you see here, you see see this over and over again in photos of the beginnings of demonstrations. Right? See, so they're the line of, you know, the black helmets here. We're seeing it from behind the police. And then over there, in fact, actually lots of helmets on the other side. But, okay, now you can look at these two guys in the front. The one in the front, he's got a silver glove on, so when he gives the finger, you can, you know, see it in silver. And then there's another guy, you know, guy behind him, with the, you know, confronting the enemy. But take a look at the orientation of the rest of the people in the crowd. This is not a focused crowd. See, they're looking in all directions. A lot of them are turned around. They're not helping out the confrontation with the police. I call those people demonstrative extremists, and we frequently see them. But the point I want to make is they're not the ones that start the riot. They're kind of, yeah, so they're acting like, you know, they're expressing what they think or want the crowd to express, but other people aren't following this as if they're, you know, too extreme for what the rest of the group wants. There's something else which is the trigger besides them. Now, indeed, and we know this from the kind of microsociology I've been doing about, you know, fist fights, bar fights, gang fights. There's an awful lot of blustering, you know, and waving your arms and shouting and cursing at people. The quotient of bluster to real violence is like, you know, 95-5 or more. So this is in the bluster phase. And in fact, you know, for on the most part, the police are kind of used to this, and they don't react to bluster. Okay, now the other component here besides an incursion into somebody else's turf is organizational breakdown. Organizational breakdown occurs when police units become cut off from each other. Higher command loses track of its own forces or the location of different groups of demonstrators. Or logistics breaks down, so the police in the field are stressed by long hours without relief and by inadequate food and water. Just came from Anthony King's conference about cohesion in modern warfare. And I was struck by how similar this is, the thing that stress, you know, troops in combat are, you know, fairly similar to the kind of things that, you know, stress police in demonstrations. The big difference being that combat usually has more or less armed people on both sides, whereas the demonstrations, if the police are the only ones with the arms, and it's very dangerous to, you know, get them going. Under such conditions, police become tense and fearful. Rumors spread among the police. Violent threats by demonstrators or deadly attacks on isolated police cars. These are the kind of things which spread around on the police net. Now, you might think that because the police net is official, that what is on it is official. Well, I mean, try listening to it sometime. You know, I mean, it's not always that easy to get hold of, but it'll come out often in court cases. The police net operates just like classic experiments on rumors, where, you know, one person sitting here, you know, says this to the person next to him, and they say it to the person next to him. And it's been, you know, proven. This was done already by psychologists back in the 1930s, that by the time you get to about the fifth or sixth person, you've lost most of the original information. And it is shifted in the direction of some kind of stereotype that people, you know, think the message ought to be. So the police are actually quite prone to rumors, and indeed, as a rule of thumb, the more, I'm not talking about riots here, I'm getting a little bit off of that topic. Police are more likely to beat somebody up the more people there are that come to the scene. And now, why is that? Well, the reason for that is that more people are coming because there is more voice traffic on the police net, and whereas the initial call may be moderately accurate, it gets more and more inaccurate as it gets further out, and it more and more morphs into things that say he's got a gun and he's, you know, threatened to not go out dead or alive. You know, it morphs into that stereotype. So the later police who come have got, you know, really quite inaccurate information about what it, you know, what's going on. So it's a typical rumor amplification kind of process. Okay, so the last point about organizational breakdown. So there are various ways in which police can, you know, be under tension, and one fairly routine factor is that police don't like having their authority questioned. You know, that's particularly true when you've got one or two cops out on patrol by themselves, so they have no immediate backup. So what they really want is kind of immediate signs that you are deferring to them, and any sign that you are not deferring to them brings a reaction of either they're going to try to really get you under control, or they're going to call for backup. And calling for backup is, on the whole, you know, fairly bad circumstance to get in for the reason that I was, you know, was just describing. Okay, now when you have a situation of a big demonstration, particularly ones that's moving through different zones of the city, and you might have police units who are called in from different jurisdictions, and you may, you know, get army units. So in effect, it's an ad hoc organization, often with not enough, you know, structure and communications. And if the demonstrators are moving around, and particularly if they deviate from the parade routes that they've announced, then police units may well find that we're cut off. I don't know where my support is. The police, for the most part, are used to being able to call for backup, and now this, the policeman's nightmare is, I'm surrounded by more people than myself, and I don't know how to get backup. Okay, now this photo is from the LA Police Department. I put this in mainly because it's a really good close-up. The LAPD now is has you know, video mounted on all their cars. So, I mean, this kind of is a routine arrest, except that this young black man is not really buying it. He's like, you know, I haven't done anything, and you know, so he's gesturally resisting. You can actually see, particularly the officer in the middle, he is really straining. I want to get him completely under control. So the you know, big tension for the police is, you know, when their effort to, you know, have things routinely under control is challenged. Okay, now I'll add one theoretical point here. We lived ever since 208 AD. Yes, right. We're waiting for the Emperor Constantine. 2008. Confrontations that threaten violence produce expressions of tension and fear, even when the participants are angry. And that's my main empirical finding from that book. In most situations, the violence does not come off because both sides are inhibited by tension and fear. Somebody's a really poor speller here. The trigger to violence is to find an opening in which the opponent momentarily shows weakness, allowing one side to acquire the emotional momentum. Now, so this is a two-step model. All right, so tension is built up. It's not just a momentary confrontation, but it's going on. And both sides are getting more tense. And then one side collapses or shows weakness. And that puts in motion what I've called a forward panic. You know, and what the great French military sociologist Charles Ardan du Pic called flight to the front. You know, our soldiers are so afraid that we don't know what we're doing, so we'll run towards the enemy. You know, wildly firing our guns and shooting everybody in sight, which might be our own people. Okay, and one more theoretical point. So, the triggers, both to set things off and to determine who's dominant, are really emotional. They are in the emotional field. Emotional dominance precedes most of the physical damage. The dangerous moment in a police riot is when high tension has built up among the police, followed by a micro trigger that sets off the police to reestablish their dominance. How do they reestablish their dominance? We're stressed, we're cut off, we don't know where our backup is, we're outnumbered. The only thing we got here are our guns, you know, or our truncheons, our billy clubs. So there's just, even though, you know, the explicit rules may be of, you know, keep calm, keep them in their parade path, et cetera, at that moment, the, you know, whatever the police tactical orders were simply get overridden. Okay? Now, I'm going back a little bit in time now. So this is before the trigger point. Okay? Now, this is, and as I said before, these are not Anna Nassauer's photos. So these are not, German or American demos. This is in Yugoslavia while it still existed, 11 or 12 years ago. You can see the usual demonstrative extremist, the guy out front there with the hanging cigarette who's engaged in a kind of a stare down contest with the security police, another guy over here shouting at them angrily. But the photo's good enough, you can actually see something of the faces of the riot police behind their masks. And they look pretty impassive. They don't look frightened. They don't look tense. They don't even look angry. It's just like, we're just holding. They're not being provoked by that guy. On the whole, that's true. In general, these people, the individuals don't start it. Now, we know this from interviews, and this is Anna Nassauer's data. The police typically view a crowd as consisting of a small number of potential troublemakers plus a much larger group of peaceful demonstrators. In fact, this is empirically true in all the demonstrations that have been able to get any kind of data on. As I said before, it's about 10% who do pretty much all the violence. So the police are aware of that. Nevertheless, the police also believe that the small violent group can infect the majority, taking them over emotionally and turning them all irrationally violent. So the police in English-speaking countries will frequently say, yeah, we know they're mostly peaceful, but they get hijacked by that group. And at that point, the whole crowd goes berserk. That's the police interpretation of it. Now, in fact, this is very much a projection of what's happening in the emotional field. But okay, now this photo happens to be from a settler demonstration in Israel protesting against one or another move to shut down certain villages, and the newspaper tag on this says violent stone throwing demonstration on the West Bank. Now, looking at the photo, I see exactly one man throwing a rock. The guy next to him, hauling the rug, isn't paying any attention to him. These guys down here in the front looking in various directions. Amazingly enough, you got people in the background down there, some of which have guns, and nobody seems to pay any attention to them. Right? So now I know that the way journalistic photo services operate, they get a whole lot of photo feed, and then they try and pick out the ones with the most action. So if there's a bias, it's towards this is the most violence we can find. So kind of on the whole, when we try to photograph demonstrations, you deliberately go out there and try to photograph. It's kind of disappointing because it's too thin. You don't see enough of this. All right? So I think this actually sort of illustrates this. So kind of on the whole, some of those guys with cops, I think, the ones up at the front, those are IDF, Israeli Defense Force officers. And they're kind of like, okay, there's one guy throwing rocks. So it's like it's nothing really. We don't have a crowd in operation here. Okay, so now when the police, after a buildup of tension, launch an attack, they no longer distinguish between the two groups, and they tend to indiscriminately beat up all those in their path who are ready targets, including non-resisting persons, women, or even bystanders, or news media. Okay, now here's a photo. I just pulled something up that I could easily find this afternoon on my computer. But this is a really typical sort of picture. Like, okay, once we get going, who's this kind of old granny lady there? Well, she's been infected by the the violence of the crowd. Knock her down too, right? Now it kind of to see it from the police point of view, and I mean that sort of literally, to see it from the police point of view. There's a couple of terrific books which They're both cited in my 2008 book. They're psychologists debriefing police who've been in shootouts. Say, what's it like to be in a shootout? Time slows down. You look, feel like you're in a tunnel vision. All you can see is your target in front of you. You can't hear the gunshot of the officer next to you. In other words, they're going into this psychological tunnel where quite literally, they aren't very able to see that. You know, that's an old granny light over there. It's like, you know, we're in the midst of, you know, this hot rush of, you know, these people have become dangerous and we've got to reassert control. I've got a lot more photos like that, but that will do for today. So, these are micro-situational processes. Police violence can be triggered by panicky demonstrators running away and falling down, creating an emotional field in which one cop is quickly joined by others alongside him in beating the fallen. And Anna Nassauer has, you know, some, you know, extended examples of this. I want to emphasize a couple points, and some of these may be useful to you if you ever get into this sort of situation. Don't fall down. I mean, no matter what you do, I mean, if the guy's going to hit you and you think he's going to hit you in the head, turn around and let him hit you in the head. He probably won't. The worst thing you can do is fall down, because that's kind of guaranteed that he probably will hit you. Not only will he probably hit you, but the cop behind him will see, oh, well, he hit him, they must have a good reason to hit him, or maybe it's just a, you know, kind of a collective flow type of thing. So once somebody becomes a target for one of the cops, he'll become a target for quite a few others. You know, so you get this kind of piling on pattern that happens. Am I missing something? Oh, yes. Okay. All right. So each of these little episodes, you know, where violence breaks out, typically ends in a few seconds. I mean, on the whole, if it's a big crowd, the police don't have time to, you know, spend, you know, beating up one person for a lengthy period. And this is pretty striking. So this is a direct quote out of Nassauer. Calmer demonstrators can regain emotional equilibrium by facing the police and calling out to them in a clear, decisive voice. Such expressions are, and these are from German demonstrations, maybe they work better in Germany, "We are peaceful, how about you?" Literally, she says, now, clear, decisive voice, and then she makes a point of saying, if you scream, that just kind of puts you in the mode of, okay, there's this irrational person over there. You know, so, I mean, you'd be screaming because you're hurt or because you're outraged or you're so surprised, you know, why would they attack, you know, an invalid like me? But nevertheless, you know, it's the wrong emotional message to send. You've got to send the message of, I'm a calm, normal, collected person, and I can speak to you in a straightforward way. You know, so, I mean, it's surprising how much... It surprised me to find out that you can actually make your way around in a riot with moderate degree of safety. I'm not going to, you know, take any bets on this. If you avoid doing the things that are going to make you particularly a target, you know. But above all, you know, it's like stand up straight, look him in the face, and be calm. Now, I'm not guaranteed that'll work everywhere. That is, if they're really looking for an excuse to beat up, you know, or kill, massacre a certain category of people. But even there, one of my other students, farmer student Stefan Klusmann, who's at Chicago now, has dug up data on the genocide in Rwanda. And he said to the extent that actually people... you know, kind of resolutely faced their attackers, they would often go and look for somebody else. It's like they prefer the ones who are cowering. Okay, second pathway, and I'm getting towards the end here. This is sort of the obverse of the first one. The first one we call police riot. So this is one which is, Anna Nassauer calls it demonstrators' offensiveness pathway to violence. And so the key here is another combination. The demonstrators are threatening violence, and typically that's a small proportion of the demonstrators who are doing that, and a portion of the demonstrators are engaging in property damage. Okay, so now this might think this is sort of a matter of, okay, certain demonstrations, they've just simply planned them to be violent, you know, and there are different cultures of demonstration, and, you know, particularly certain parts of the world. In the West, Greece is one place where the demonstrators all say, oh, it's, you know, we want to be violent, we want to be disruptive. Nevertheless, by making comparisons, Nassauer found that the whether violence breaks out or not is not really determined by whether the protest organizers chose a violent or disruptive strategy. The reason is, even deliberate violence does not occur automatically. No demonstration starts out with violence. It only emerges at certain times and circumstances, even if the chosen strategy favored violence. Now, so let me underline that. I mean, suppose you've got a demonstration where you've actually got particular factions say, we really are aimed to destroy property, fight with the police. That's not a guarantee that it's going to happen. And the reason that it won't guarantee it is because it's clearly a matter of timing, and the timing is a matter of the emotional field. And in no demonstration is the emotional field there right at the moment, at the first moment. So even though, you know, we're there and we want to, you know, generate some violence, the question is when, you know, and so it may well be that the moment doesn't actually come. So that's it. That happens in other kinds of violence as well. Okay, so violent groups that advertise themselves in violence, in recent years, particularly the Black Bloc, are very widely present in demonstrations. In fact, Nassauer said in her sample, almost all of them had the Black Bloc in them, but half of the demonstrations did not turn violent. Furthermore, even the presence of weapons among demonstrators does not automatically lead to violence. I mean, so these are usually low-level weapons, so a moment when people start gathering stones to throw or inflammable materials. Nevertheless, even that is not the key turning point. So what is the key turning point? Okay, here's just one photo of the Black Bloc. Actually, I think this is street theater to a large extent, but there's definitely this, you know, ideology of we're not going to take violence from the police. You know, we're going to dish it out ourselves. Or again, the anti-W2O demo in Genoa in 2001. So this is one taken from the side of the demonstrators, and you see two rock throwers out in front. Now you might think, okay, this is the moment that precipitates the violence. In fact, it doesn't. That's not violence. You know, I mean, other than this rather ineffective throwing of rocks, if the police over there don't have their shields on, so that didn't precipitate it. And you can tell. Look at the orientation of the people in the crowd. Some of them are looking towards the front, but quite a lot of them are, you know, in different orientations. They're not galvanized as a, you know, as an attacking group. Okay, all of this actually fits a key finding in the microsociology of violence: that violence is not easy, and it only occurs when there is a facilitating emotional field. Threats of violence are, on the whole, rhetorical bluster, an effort at intimidation. Threatening bluster is present in many kinds of confrontations, but threat alone is insufficient to produce violence. Okay, now this, one of the things I like about this photo, this is Madrid 2004, it's right after the big bombing of the Ochoa train station. It happened, you know, just before an election. There was actually a big outpouring of the left. So the government rigged it, so we'll win the election. It actually, turned the whole tide there. But more in a micro direction, this man in the middle is a really good example of somebody angry. That's an angry face, right? I mean, you can see the brow, you can see the mouth. This demonstration did not turn violent. Right? Just the fact that you have angry people, and even very demonstrably angry people. You can see a bit of a cute to it in here. And you look at this cop's face. He's looking at him more or less directly, but his face is impassive. I mean, he's neither angry nor upset, you know, by it. The emotional field is, well, okay, you're venting, right? So, you know, people who are venting don't actually get a lot of respect. Demonstrators escalate the situation by causing property damage, breaking windows, looting, and setting fires. The people who do this, the Black Bloc, for example, tend to define this activity as nonviolent. They say, attacking only inanimate objects rather than human beings. But the police find this tension-raising because it violates their normal commitment to stopping crimes. It's the kind of thing, if you weren't having a demonstration, the police would immediately want to make an arrest. So the police, it makes the police more tense. A more subtle consequence that Nassauer pointed out. Only a minority of 10% or less of the demonstrators may engage in property damage, but it affects the other 90% because it makes them more tense. The majority dislike this portrayal of themselves as destructive people, and they may even attempt to stop the property destruction. It also makes them fearful of what the police will do. So there's this strange unintended consequence of property damage by a small percentage. That is, it increases the tension on both sides. This creates an emotional field pervaded with tension, and both sides become more upset. This sets the stage for tipping points which violence breaks out. The orderliness of the demonstration is broken, and that of the police as well. And as we'll see in the following sets of photos, there's this huge distinction between the early part of the demonstration, what I call the standoff phase. People stand in solid lines. You may have some emotional demonstrations by a few individuals, but the lines remain steady. During the violent phase, the crowd breaks up into little clusters, and this is the dangerous part. Okay, so now you might think, that's pretty confrontational, but look at the faces of the crowd control forces. They're like just, solid expressions on their face. I'm not going to be affected by you, although maybe there's a little bit of a feeling of, if we get an opportunity here, I'm going to get you, but right, as of not yet. On the other hand, this is what it looks like when the violence breaks out. Now, those of you go to movies may find this a little bit weird because Hollywood directors and all other directors kind of like to choreograph this thing where everybody is beating on everybody else. You have two big lines like a rugby scrimmage. But, where they're, and in reality, they all look like this. I mean, this just happened to be one that took place in Cairo in 2006. The lines break up, and then you get basically little clusters of people running around. Now, what the dangerous thing that happens here is when the clusters consolidate like this. Now, I'm going to show you both on the same side. That is, clusters, I've counted them. And when you get clusters of one person who is surrounded by somewhere between 3, 6, 7 other people, there you've got the situation where somebody is going to get beat up. So over and over again. So the demonstrators, the active or violent part of the demonstrators, this happens to be from Argentina, form together in a little clusters if they're giving each other emotional support in the rock throwing. The police often look the same way. In the background, they've got somebody who they've knocked down onto the ground, and they handcuff behind their back. These police actually look fairly tense, but it's the arithmetical thing here that's so striking, that little circle of 6 or 7 people with one in the middle. I've got a lot more of those photos, and that's an overwhelming pattern. Okay, getting very near the end here. Nassauer and her data located what you can call a danger time zone, the period between about 1.5 hours to 2.5 hours after the demonstration has begun, is the time when violence is most likely to be triggered off. At the beginning, they haven't built up enough tension for it to happen. And apparently after about 2.5 hours, the demonstration loses whatever tension it's developed. It's like people become habituated to the standoff, and whatever tension there is goes away. Nassauer actually, is a piece of research that has some practical payoffs, not just for the police, but for us as ordinary people. She suggests micro-interactional tactics can be used to prevent violence, such as specific ways for demonstrators to talk to the police and vice versa that have the effect of keeping tension from growing into uncontrolled violence. All right, and my conclusion then, you know, if I had more time, I could run through another, you know, half a dozen really interesting recent empirical studies using video data of various sort. We're in the age of microsociology, and I can pretty much guarantee that it's going to, you know, keep on growing, you know, just because, you know, so much more visual, auditory, and other kinds of micro data is becoming available if we know how to read them. Thank you for your attention.